Live from the Fish House, we're offering our live reading series as podcasts. If you enjoy listening to poetry and to our podcasts, please consider supporting the Fish House, a nonprofit audio archive of emerging poets. Visit us at fishhousepoems.org, F-I-S-H-O-U-S-E, poems.org. Fish House is pleased to present a reading by poet Brian Turner, recorded live in Denver, Colorado, on April 10th, 2010, at the launch party for his second collection, Phantom Noise, the much-anticipated follow-up to his best-selling debut collection, Hear Bullet, both published by Alice James Books. The event was sponsored by Alice James and by Blue Flower Arts. Brian Turner has been the recipient of numerous awards and prizes, a Lannan Literary Fellowship, a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship and Poetry, the Poets Prize, and the Amy Lowell Traveling Poetry Scholarship. He currently teaches at Sierra Nevada College in Lake Tahoe, California.
It's wonderful to see you here and to have you here with us to celebrate Brian's new book. So I'm Carrie Salerno. I'm the executive director of Alice James. We are Brian's publisher, and we're a cooperative nonprofit press. We're located in Farmington, Maine, and we publish 6 books a year. We have a cooperative board. That's how we choose our manuscripts. And I just want to say a couple of words of thanks before we get going. And firstly, I'd like to thank Blue Flower Arts for co-sponsoring this event. And of course, the beautiful Allison Granucci. And I'd also really like to thank Benjamin Percy and Carolyn Forche for coming out tonight to speak for and support Brian Turner's work. It's really wonderful to have you both here tonight with us. I'd also like to thank Matt O'Donnell from the Fish House. He's doing some recording for us, so that's very wonderful. And all of the Alices that are at the conference this week that have helped us both at the book table and tonight for this event, and the lovely Julia Bausma, who's in the back corner selling books that were unfortunately all sold out of. So I guess I have to thank all of you for that support as well. But she's been working tremendously hard at this event, and I think we all owe her a round of applause as well. So please. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and turn the mic over to Allison so we can get this thing started. So please welcome her up here.
Thank you all for coming out. It's amazing to see all these people here. So I'm Allison Granucci, and I'm the owner, president of Blue Flower Arts, which is a literary speakers bureau. So Alice James, of course, publishes Brian. And we represent him for his readings and speakings around the country and around the world. So I also am very honored and blessed that two of our other clients, Benjamin Percy and Carolyn Frasche, have agreed to come and speak to the wonders of Brian and his writing. So without further ado, Benjamin Percy is a fiction writer. He is the author of Refresh, Refresh, and another collection of short stories, plus a novel that is forthcoming this fall called The Wilding. He'll say a few words, and then Carolyn Forche will introduce Brian. I don't know anyone in this room who would not know who Carolyn Forche is, beloved poet. Pshaw. Poet of Witness, author of Blue Hour and Blue Angel, and the renowned and famed anthology Against Forgetting. And we are very honored to have everyone here tonight, so please welcome first Benjamin Percy.
There's the war we know from Hollywood and CNN about dirt-smeared soldiers disarming IEDs and roaring along in Humvees and kicking down doors of terrorist hideouts. The war that, sadly, can seem as distant as a video game. And then there's the battleground of the mind, the war that Brian Turner carried home with him like a rucksack full of dynamite. The writer is a servant of memory, Barry Lopez once told me. And Brian Turner does his duty as a writer by forcing us to remember what is most important, not the headlines about Paris Hilton and Tiger Woods, but the news that's buried on page 7, the news about a bomb ripping through a traffic checkpoint, the brigade ambushed outside of Kirkuk. Anywhere in America, you can walk into a coffee shop and see people drinking cappuccinos and tapping their laptops and listening to their iPods and laughing about a television program they watched the night before. While on the other side of the globe, M16s rattle, mortar rounds explode, flames rise from a twisted snarl of metal, a Humvee ripped to pieces, a soldier melted into its gun turret. We might be able to change the channel, to turn the dial on the radio, to skim past a disturbing article. But Brian doesn't have that luxury, because the news is in his head. The ghosts of Iraq have followed him home, and he brings them to life in phantom noise now with a staggering arsenal of talent. His words pop like small arm fire. His poems scare a gasp out of you like tracer rounds burning in the night sky over your hometown. Welcome him, one of our most exciting and important poets, and a hell of a good guy.
You have an incredible voice. We all know that Here Bullet arose out of Brian's experiences as a member of 3rd Striker Brigade Combat Team 2nd Infantry Division beginning in November 2003. And before that, he was with the 10th Mountain Division deployed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. I'm here to honor him today and to say something that needs to be said. Bosnia-Herzegovina and Iraq did not make Brian Turner a poet. Poetry took hold of those wars through him, as it took hold of the poets who preceded him. Brian Turner is one of the most intellectually thoughtful and curious and deeply read and now widely traveled poets that I know. But what impresses me most, other than his mastery of his art, is his immense gratitude for just about everything. Every moment, every accolade, every prize, and he has received them with immense dignity, and I honor him for that. It's pretty easy to let this stuff go to your head, and of course, he was on the, you know, Jim Lehrer NewsHour and BBC and NPR and all the things that we poets never are, and I'm really impressed with him, and should be, with courage and uncommon willingness to see the world as it actually is. Brian Turner returns in Phantom Noise with a bullet-borne language in which helicopters, I love this image of his, hover like spiders over a film of water. His poem, Alaima Bridge, alone proves his mastery and joins him to the tradition of Wilfred Owen and David Jones and Yusuf Komunyakaa and Bruce Weigel, for he is their descendant. His poetic gifts detonated into a spray of lyric force that will mark what is possible in poetry for years to come. A chiseling of agony onto paper and a poignant cri de coeur to the Republic of Conscience. Brian.
There is this ringing hum, this bullet-borne language, ringing shellfall and static, this late-night ringing of threadwork and carpet, ringing hiss and steam, this wingbeat of rotors and tanks, broken bodies ringing in steel, humming these voices of dust, these years ringing rifles in Babylon, rifles in Sumer, ringing these children their gravestones and candy, their limbs gone missing, their static-born television, they're ringing this eardrum, this rifled symphonic, this ringing of midnight and gunpowder and oil, this brake pad gone useless, this muzzle flash singing, this threading of bullets and muscle and bone, this ringing hum, this ringing. And I'd say if you don't hear it, then you're not listening. There are thousands of people coming back. And are we hearing the people across the globe that have that same, that they're hearing this problem? You know what I mean? For decades, we, as you'd said so eloquently, people can turn to other subjects. We have a lot of shit in our lives we have to attend to. But we as a nation are responsible for a slaughter. What will you do about that? Let me catch my breath for a second, all right? Yeah, fine. I was nervous as hell coming up here. I still am. I mean, look around the room. Jeez, there's all these writers, and I'm supposed to read poetry to you guys? You know? Yeah. Well, I'll just do it, and then we'll see what happens. This is the first time for me to crack open this book and start reading poems to people, you know? I've read a few of the poems as they're being written and stuff, but so it's like pushing a boat into the water or something, you know? So. Zippo. Just to prove his point, Stoltman unscrews the tanker's fuel cap, grinning the way he always does, a cigarette dangling from his lips, a feigned concentration on his forehead, though under tissue and bone, a focus deeper than the prank at work, calculating flash points and fire points, diesel and flame, the paperwork with his wife's signature sealed by the hard-pressed pen. Stoltman flips open the hinged metal, its polished chrome worn by sweat and grime, his free hand dunked to the wrist in fuel, soaked and dripping as he pulls it out into the morning chill. And when he strikes the thumb wheel to flint the wick's naphtha, nobody moves. Nobody stops him. Nobody says a word. Because we all want to see if Stoltman will burn. That was kind of a nice note right then. Yeah. Thanks, man. Is there anybody here from the Air Force Academy just up the road? No? Ah, dang. I was talking with them last night. They were drinking at Murphy's. I think they might still be crashed out. So, but I was there last year, and I went. I want to thank a lot of people in this room because I visited many colleges in the last 5 years. And I got to say, going to the Air Force Academy, I've been to all four major military service academies. And the Air Force was, of those four, for example, was incredibly gracious. There were a couple of thugs that were like my goons that walked me around everywhere and stuff. Really good guys, though. They have an amazing, this might sort of break some stereotypes for some people, I don't know. But they have a very progressive English department there at the Air Force Academy. They have some really, the war literature and the arts has, well, they had a thing. I don't know if you haven't talked to them, stop by sometime and talk with them. Because I think they feel sort of that there's a stereotype it's hard for them to break out of when they come to a place like this, you know? But when I was there, there were no other dignitaries that had shown up at that particular time. So for some reason, there's this Rampart Lodge on the base, and I got to stay where Dick Cheney had stayed, the same room. Which means I had to sleep in the same bed. You know what I mean? So I had to write a poem, and it's called Sleeping in Dick Cheney's Bed. It's unnerving how comfortable this is. NORAD watching over the bedroom, Colorado mule deer chewing the dawn as I dream. Outside as I dream, I'm wading thigh high into the North Platte River, wearing rubber waders, casting a handmade fly with a whip-like graceful sling of the line until I fall back, plunge into the cold rushing white water, my eyes blurred hard under the sun's interrogations, Cheney's hands like a preacher's delivering me deeper into the truth. With a gasp of air, a flash of light, to be plunged back down the way he offers midges and bloodworms and rusty scuds to the cloudy river, running 1,400 cubic feet per second, until I cough up the fictional and beg for the heartland's fluid clarity, salvation, the charity of forgiveness, anything to unravel the dream and return me back my California bed, my lover beside me, and not this stale man's breath clinging to the Egyptian cotton sheets, the hanging curtains, the flaring light of Colorado Springs where Cheney slept in this very bed. Both of us held by the same coiling box spring, goose down pillows cupping our heads gently into sleep. The reddening glow of Mars rising over the horizon, dead skin sloughed off to coat my own skin at an invisible level. And still, what does it say about me? that the Pinot Grigio tasted so good on my tongue, and that I struggled to be a sergeant tonight, speaking to the officer corps in a theater filled with 1,600 listening faces as I spoke about rape, death, and murder. What does it say about me that I can return to Cheney's bed in the room after midnight, to strip my clothes off and curl in the bed where he too has slept? The sheets a sublime reprieve from my tired frame. The night a perfection of sleep. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. You know, we are a nation of torturers. You know? Oh, we can forget. We got other things to do. Why drag it up? Why deal with it? Because we need to be shamed. You know? The last book, with Here Bullet, I remember I'd go and I'd talk to some people in audiences and I would say, you know, here's a poem that sucks and here's another one that sucks and, you know, here's another one. It just keeps, because there's a lot of shit we got to deal with, you know? So, I got to find stuff here. Katie Couric did a report, and one point she quoted, she said that 1 in 3 female soldiers will experience sexual assault while serving in the military. I think this is a conversation our nation has to have. I'll be back at the Air Force Academy in the fall, and I'll continue to talk about this problem, you know? And the poem is called Insignia. And for those of you who have been in the military, a sergeant has 3 stripes, and a staff sergeant has a rocker of yellow hung below for the uniform that's back on, the garrison uniform, not when they're in the field. If you see them on television, they have sometimes right here or up here is where their rank is. So, insignia. She hides under a deucin half this time, sleeping on a roll of foam draped in mosquito netting. Sand flies hover throughout the night. She sleeps under vehicle exhaust and heat, dreaming of mortars buried beside her, 3 stripes painted on each cold tube, a rocker of yellow hung below. It's you she's dreaming of, Sergeant. She'll dream of you for years to come if she makes it out of this country alive, which she probably will. You will be the fire and the hovering breath, not the sniper, not the bomber in the streets, you. So I'm here to ask for this one night's reprieve. Let her sleep tonight. Let her sleep. Pause a moment under the gibbous moon. Smoke. The gin your wife sent from New Jersey, colored mint green with food dye disguised in a bottle of mouthwash. Take a long swig of it. Take the edge out of your knuckles. Let it blur your vision into a tremor of lights. The explosions in the distance are not your own. In these long hours before dawn on the banks of the Tigris River, let her sleep. In her dream, your eyes are pools of rifle oil. You unsheathe the bayonet from its scabbard while she waits. On a mattress of sand and foam there in the motor pool, she waits to kiss bullets into your mouth. So how are you guys doing tonight, you know? I'm hoping to read a few more. I don't know how we're doing time-wise and stuff. Maybe someone could throw something at me if I push it beyond. I was a sergeant in the Army. I could talk. I'd tell stories all night long, you know, till 4 a.m., whatever. I'd love to, but I know that we have lots of stuff tonight. But I'd like to read a poem that Carolyn, you were very kind. Where is Carolyn at? You were very kind to say very nice words about this poem, so I'll read it. It'll be the first time to read it in front of people, so this is scary. But it doesn't matter about me. President Jalal Talabani said, "This will leave a scar in our souls." Do you remember when he said that? Do you remember when 1,000 people died one day and nobody, not a shot was fired? It happened. I'm not making this shit up. Do you remember? This poem is called The Alalima Bridge. They fall from the bridge into the Tigris. They fall from railings or tumble down, shoved by panic, by those in the crushing weight behind them. Mothers with children, 70-year-old men clawing at the blue and empty sky, which is too beautiful. Some focus on the bridge work as they fall, grasp the invisible rope which slips through their fingers. Some palm heel the air beneath them, pressing down as their children swim in the oxygen beside them, lives blurring with no time to make sense. Some so close to shore they smash against the rocks. The pregnant woman who twists in a corkscrew of air, flipping upside down, the world upended, her black dress like a funeral banner rippling in the wind, her child never given a name. They fall beside Shatha and Kantara and Sabine, Hakim and Askari and Gabir, unraveling years and memory, struggling to keep heads above water, the hard shock sweeping them downstream as Askari fights to gain the shoreline where emerald flags furl in sunlight, and onlookers wave frantic arms at Gabir, who holds the body of a dead child he doesn't know. And it is only 11:30 a.m., and this is how we die, he thinks, on a day as beautiful as this. And Shatha, who feels the river's cold hands pulling her under, remembers once loving the orange flowers opening on the hillsides of Mosul, how she lay under slow clouds drifting in history's bright catalog. They fall with 500-pound bombs and mortars, laser-guided munitions directing the German Luftwaffe from 1941, Iraqi jets and airmen from the Six-Day War, the Battle of Karbala, the 1 million who died fighting Iran, and Alexander the Great falls, and King Faisal, and the Israeli F-16s that bombed the reactor in 81, and the Stella the Vultures comes crumbling, the Tower of Samarra, the walled ruins of Nineveh, the Babylonians and Sumerians and Assyrians join them, falling from the bridge with Ibn Khaldun's torn pages, the Muqaddimah, that classic Islamic history of the world. And Scheherazade falls too, exhausted, worn out from her life-saving work, made speechless by the scale of war, and Ali Baba with an AK-47 beside her. Whiskey and vodka, pirated Eastern European porn videos, the children hawked to soldiers, the freaky freaky, they call it, and foil-wrapped packages of heroin, heroin, thrown to the river. The year 1956 slides under, along with 49 and 31 and 17, the month of October, the months of June, July, and August, the many months to follow, each day's exquisite light, the many months to follow, the snowfall in Mosul, the photographs a family took of children rolling snowballs, throwing them before licking the pink cold from their fingertips. Years unravel like filaments of straw, bleached gold and given to the water, 1967 and 1972, 2001 and 2002, what will we remember? What will we say of these? It wakens the dead from the year 1258, who cannot believe what is happening here. Not a shot fired. Internalized panic, deeply set by years of warfare, the siege and adrenaline always at the surface, prepared. The dead from the year 1258 read the ancient scrolls cast into the river from the House of Wisdom, the eulogies of nations given water's swift erasure. And the dead watch as they are swept downstream, witness to the soft, tender lips of the river fish who kiss the calves and fingertips of these newly dead, curious to see how lifeless bodies stare hard into that dark envelopment, hands waving to the far shore. The jinn awaken from their slumber to watch the dead pass by, one fixed with an odd smile, the drawn-out vowel of a word left unfinished. And they want to hold these dead close and tight, the lung's last reserve given as a whisper of bubbles for the ear held up to it. The jinn swim to reach the bony ankles of Sabine, the muscled Askari, clasping to stop them from this tragic undertaking. And some are nearly saved by others diving in to rescue the terrified and stunned, but drown under a woman's soaked abaya. And the Tigris is filling with the dead, filling with bricks from Abu Ghraib, burning vehicles pushed from Highway 1 with rebar, stone, metal, with rubble from the mosque bombed in Samarra, guard towers and razor wire imprisoning to Crete. It fills with the pipelines of money, marketplace bombs, roadside bombs, vehicle-driven bombs, and the bombs people make of themselves. Gilgamesh can do nothing. Knows that each life is the world dying anew, each body the deep pull of currents below, lost, and lost within each, the subtle, the sublime, the horrific, the mundane, the tragic, the humorous and the erotic, lost. Unstudied in textbooks, courses on mathematics, the equations quantifying fear, or the stoppage of time this eternal moment creates, unwritten history, forgotten in American hallways, but still, give them flowers from the hills, flowers from the Shanidar cave, where mourning has a long history, where someone in the last ice age gathered a bouquet. Give daisies and hyacinths to this impossible moment, flowers to stand for the lips unable to kiss them, each in their own bright beauty, flowers that may light the darkness as they march deeper into the earth. That's thank you. Do you guys remember that? They were crossing the bridge, and somebody thought maybe there was a suicide bomber among them. Not a shot was fired. 1,000 people died that day, roughly, you know? And they had there was a photograph of Baghdad. Yeah. And it was during a religious celebration, and they were crossing over, and they tumbled off the gentleman, Ahmed Nassif, who wrote this, or who painted this painting. He lives in Baghdad, and he has another painting. It's this beautiful painting, tragically and horribly beautiful, of these colors coming off the bridge into the water. But I don't mean to indict. I don't mean to, highlight our complicity and the culpable nature of our relationship with Iraq. But if we don't remember, isn't there some fundamental problem with that? You know? Ted Koppel was reading the lists of the dead, you know, the American dead, which I commend, you know? I commend that process. But there's a longer list that also needs to be added to that one. Much longer list. You know, when will we read those names? So I'm gonna look for this next poem. Do you guys mind to read a few more short ones, and then we can have some more alcohol and stuff? Then you can mill around and talk and stuff. I'd like to meet. There's a shitload of people in here. We still got some time. I was walking over here. I almost walked to the wrong place. I went down. Did you guys go down by the creek and stuff? And I saw a beaver in the water yesterday, just paddling along. I thought it was a big rat at first because I just couldn't believe it'd actually be a beaver. And there was a beaver went by. It was fantastic. But as I was coming back here, I got confused. I went in the wrong place, and I walked in, and there were people all in blue jackets and black, and nobody had a brown jacket. I really felt sort of, you know, out of place a little bit. And I look in, and I look, and it's weird because I'm mostly of Scots-Irish heritage, and I'm a white guy, but I'm looking around, and I was like, there's a shitload of white people here. They were all white. I was like, what? Where's the rest of America? You know, it seemed a little kind of weird, you know, but I don't know. But then I found my way. I had to go through the car thing and see the car sculptures, the car show, and then come here. '66. Muhammad trains for the Beijing Olympics, 2008. Oh, and for you guys, this is in 10 and 12 syllable lines because he was a weightlifter in a certain weight class. So I thought I should have some kind of like weight class or something, you know, for what it's worth. So, in the 69 kilogram weight class, the Bulgarian Boevski is a world record holder. He cannot be beaten, at least not by Sawara Muhammad. Muhammad, at 26, has shoveled cement longer than he cares to remember. In Arbil, in Kurdish northern Iraq, he strains hard to lift the barbell with its heavy plates, round as the wheels of chariots. Then muscles give, and the wheels bounce in dust before him. No, he cannot defeat the Bulgarian. The problem is in lifting weight over distance. It isn't a matter of iron or of will. In Beijing, Boevski's records will go unnoticed because Muhammad is training now to lift the city of Arbil with its people. His quadriceps and posterior chain straining, the muscles tremoring to lift the Euphrates and Tigris, both mountains of the north, deserts of the west, Basra, Karbala, Ramadi, Tikrit, Mosul, 3 decades of war and the constant suffering of millions. This is what Sawara lifts. And no matter what effort he makes, he will fail completely, and the people will love him for it. And I have read that before, and I'd like to say that I sometimes ask this question, say, don't you love that effort, you know? Don't you love the Iraqi people, how they, and now the Afghanistan people, I guess we can talk about them now finally, we haven't talked about them for years, even though we've been kicking their ass for a while. You know, knocking in their doors. I was one of those guys kicking in doors. I kicked in the door of somebody's house because I was so scared. I didn't realize, I thought, you know, I was pumped up on adrenaline. But I was supposed to knock on the door, you know. And it was like 6 a.m. It was a door, it was a metal door. I kicked it in and we went in. And there were like 11 people sleeping along this one floor of this house. And we nearly shot the grandmother who came in through the doorway because she came in fast, you know. And that's happening now. As we sit here, or stand here, as we enjoy our drinks afterwards, or have our lattes and cappuccinos, you know? Yeah. It's obscene. Yeah. So, on the other hand, I want to enjoy the life we're given and we're living. It's a difficult thing to do. I'm going to read a quiet poem now that maybe most of these poems tonight that I've been reading from this have been sort of looking overseas more, but this one looks a little bit more, but it's a quiet poem and it's set here in the States. I was driving across from California to Florida to see Elise. She lives in Orlando, and my fiance. We're getting married in September. So there's good things too. Thank you. Thank you. Guys, thank her when you see her because she's very good. She said yes, you know? Holy shit. but I stopped. My family, one part of my family is from Arkansas, south of Little Rock, and I wanted to see this place called Sibley Hole, where my grandfather used to fish when he was a kid, and all these stories he told. And I went to. Can you guys hear me in the back too? So, okay, cool. And this poem comes from being there. But it's called White Phosphorus. You guys know what white phosphorus is? Okay. If you don't, look it up because it's pretty horrible stuff. But it's called White Phosphorus. When Larry Jr. nails a catfish to the trunk of a black tupelo, the summer tanagers and dark-eyed juncos pause in their singing to the afternoon. And it isn't the hammer or the nail driving it in. It's that low vowel of pain stretching out over the Arkansas River and into the sway of pines, a sound that travels along Dollar Way Road and on into town, where Ray and Suzanne have forgotten how to talk with one another, steam curling over their coffee at the diner. Across the street, the old man Jackson loses his train of thought, straining to recall the year 1928, the shade tree where Uncle Harold was buried after the gas of the Argonne Forest finally took him down. It's like this at International Paper and at the county courthouse. It's like this at the back parking lot of the Duck Inn's Chateau Lounge, where Marlene has finally broken down, her forehead on the steering wheel. Even in the soybean fields and poultry farms outside of town, this pause, this quiet recognition, here in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where it's made. But I think that town, Pine Bluff, Arkansas, is an analog for America, you know? Here, where it's made. Yeah. You have? Cool. Have you seen Sibley Hole? You have? We gotta talk about this afterwards, yeah. There was a water moccasin came right up to the thing. And they're not friendly. Yeah. Well, it's his hole, you know. So, all right, I respect that. Yeah. Elise and I went to the Guggenheim Museum, and this poem was written after going there. And this is near the end of the book, and it's called In the Guggenheim Museum. We follow Frank Lloyd Wright's rotunda with our hands herringbone together. The curving ramp of galleries like the cochlea of the inner ear. And she kisses me on the rounded bone behind the earlobe, a structure whose name I don't know, before working our way through the crowd of art-filled heads, their faces radiating the blonde ale they drink at lunch as they slur Kandinsky on their tongues, words in lavender brushstrokes, conversations trailing behind them like multicolored scarves which brush over our forearms and shoulders, disconnected from their source, mysterious, beautiful, fleeting. At the entrance to the sound and light exhibit, we read the poster board thoughts of the artist. Or maybe it's a type message from someone who once talked with the artist. Or maybe they simply wrote what they thought the artist might say or think, telling us, remove your shoes, to feel the carpet's texture, the floor's vibration, and decibels below the threshold of human hearing, a no-speaking zone, a place for wavelengths of visible light, tonal harmonics reconciling the Precambrian structures of the brain, oscillating through the millennia to converse with our bipedal, awkward, face-to-face making of love, which is all she and I can think of now. The unified theory of color conjoined with sound, as she squeezes my hand tight in her own under the wire-hung letters of language, which rotate above us in a perfectly destroyed state. The letter C, the letter S, each letter stretched, bent a little out of plane, as if the invisible paper of language had been peeled away so that now they drift over us, freed from the word chair or staircase. Vibrations of sound gently lifting the alphabet and lowering it the way a breeze might lift the tips of her hair. My fingers guiding the zipper in its channel, tooth by tooth, the way it did last night in the park, Long after closing time, when the sprinklers switched on and we didn't stop, the killdeers singing, a siren somewhere off in the distance, the sun itself held at bay by the horizon, just long enough to divot the soft lawn with her kneecaps pressing down, shifting to the rocking of hips, my own back given the imprint of earth authored by the grass in its green vernacular, muscles lifting, my thumbs at the iliac crest, the smooth curve of her breast, the street lamps tapered like candles to backlight her silhouette as we kissed the small, quick fires from each other's mouths, cold water falling in a graceful arc from the sprinkler heads positioned around us, her hair matted and tangling with it. This is what I'm thinking about as we walk through the museum. The skeletons of art hung around us, petrified, staring through hard lenses of framing and oil, staring at us from their fossilized stations in the past, in wonder, marveling at these two lovers here, each of us fully given to the inexorable process of death, and yet, here we are, walking among them, alive. What will you do with your life? You know, let's live. Look at all these amazing people here tonight. This is an incredible room full of people. So I'm not going to go through a long list of people to thank because it's so long, you know. I mean, I don't mean to diminish that in any way. Do you know what I mean? It's not. I don't mean that as a joke in any way. I owe so much to so many people in this room, and in the future, maybe more of you in this room as well. And I don't know if I'll be able to personally talk to all of you in the room tonight. But look around. See all the people in the back. There's Ofer. Right? There's Cyrus, you know, there's all these people. You know, Michael Thomas over here. Get to know each other if you don't. And is that Dunya? No, I don't see you. Okay. Yeah, I thought I saw Dunya. I was like, oh, amazing. And, you know, get to know some people today while you can, you know, because we'll be dead soon, you know. You know, we will. We'll be dead soon. But now we are alive. And do something with the time, you know. All right, with much love. You guys have a good night.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this reading by poet Brian Turner, author of the collections Hear Bullet and Phantom Noise, recorded live in Denver, Colorado on April 10th, 2010, sponsored by Alice James Books and Blue Flower Arts. From the Fish House is a free resource for poets, poetry fans, and teachers and students of contemporary poetry. As a nonprofit, we rely on the generosity of you, our listeners, to support our programming. If you enjoy listening to our poetry and value this service, please consider a contribution to the Fish House. Visit us online at fishhousepoems.org, fishousepoems.org. I'm Matt O'Donnell, editor of From the Fish House. Thank you for listening and for your support.